This is XTP Media.
If you're an early customer for the 777, what you replace it with is another 777. Airbus make good aircraft, but I don't think they've got anything that is quite as good as the 777.
It was just piecing this story of something, you know, an aeroplane which was which had sunk, was under the water, had been there for years, and had suddenly been found.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Ready for takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this extra episode of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. You heard there from our two guests, Andy Jones from Plane Hunters and Kevin James, author of Heathrow Airport, An Illustrated History, and Airport Days and Nights, Terminals and Runways. Kevin has a lot to say for himself, so we look forward to hearing from him shortly. But first, we're going to hear from Andy Jones and Plane Hunters. But before we do that, I just wanted to say a big thank you to everybody who sent us good wishes. We've been off the airwaves for a little while. A little explanation. Unfortunately, I got a little unwell and as a result lost part of my hearing. So as you can imagine, making podcast probably wasn't a wise thing to do. But we're back. We've got some more content in the pipeline for you. So let's get right onto this episode. And first, we're going to hear from Andy and Plane Hunters. Andy, welcome to Extended.
Hi, Peter, and thanks for having me this evening.
It's delightful to have you on the show. I stumbled across Plane Hunters, but tell us how you got into aviation.
Well, my background in aviation, I suppose, like a lot of people, I am a frustrated fighter pilot. So I'm probably like a lot of people who are listening at the moment. I never quite made it into the jump seat or the cockpit in that sense. But my family basically is where aviation background comes from. My uncle was a fighter pilot in the RAF. 30 odd years. He was on Lightnings, Hunters, was in the Arrows during the late 60s with Ray Hanna. He was actually on the BBMF as well. My father was in the RAF Reserve and actually started the Aircraft Museum in Southampton back in the early 1970s, which is now known as Solent Sky. It was a lot smaller when he started it. It was only two aircraft. It's now quite a big affair. So I grew up in and around aircraft. My playground literally was, you know, sort of at the weekends, a Spitfire and a Supermarine S6, Vampire and Venom and things. So I couldn't get away from aircraft in that sense. And I desperately wanted to be a pilot as a kid. But for some reason, I took a different turn when I was a teenager and got involved in film and photography. But I've always kept that passion for aviation. There's something really, really deep inside my bones about that. And I think you'll appreciate that, yeah, as well.
We got it in our DNA.
There's absolutely, you can't quite put your finger on it. But my day job, I work as a video producer. I've worked on broadcast projects for a number of years, and I do a lot of corporate and commercial stuff. And Plane Hunters has really been a sort of marriage of the day job and my passion, which is aviation, and bringing it together.
Oh, I didn't know that. Let's talk about Plane Hunters then. How did that come around? It's high quality, really good stuff.
Well, it came about. We've had kind of two sort of areas which we've gone into, which is the features and the bulletins. I'll sort of explain that concept a little bit later. But it came about largely from frustrations of trying to get TV programs onto channels and talking to commissioning editors and trying to get somebody to make a decision to make good programs on aviations and things that I was interested in. Anybody who's had anything to do with broadcast television, you'll find that the commissioning process is quite long-winded, and you can end up in a situation that if you have a great idea that you really think is going to fly well, if it does get on television, by the time it's got there, it's probably not the idea you started off with, because there will have been a lot of people sort of pulling and poking it in various different directions, and it's quite frustrating. I've heard some horror stories of sort of commissioning editors turning down incredibly good ideas, and I think if anyone who is sort of from us sort of aviation sort of people, if you've got a real interest in aviation, you look at some of the content on television, you can be a bit let down by what's out there. And so about 3 or 4 years ago, we approached a couple of broadcasters with the idea of looking at some of these sort of some of these stories as features. And frustrated by the response we got, I put it on the back burner, forgot about it until last year when I was having a coffee with an ex-BBC cameraman. And we thought, well, hold on, why don't we just make this ourselves and get it out there and see what happens? And it's been great. We've had a fantastic response. We've made 2 or 3 features now. We're making some more this year and this summer. And we've also started doing what we refer to as a historic aviation bulletin, which, again, we're finding our way with that. It's a little bit of a new thing, but we've had some tremendous sort of compliments from what we're getting out there, which is great.
You have feature episodes and you have these bulletins. Tell us a little bit about the structure of Plane Hunters.
Yeah, now that's interesting, because we are looking at historic aviation, but it's funny, although we refer to this as historic aviation, I always like to find the line to the present, and most of these stories that we pick up on, we can find something that is relevant to what's going on in aviation today. And funny, I'll give you a great example of that. Last week, we put out a very short film on using 3D technology, scanning in a Spitfire, which was done in a matter of hours. And we're now looking at how we can maybe 3D print some pieces of this Spitfire to a standard. And of course, the application for that is great, because it's restoration of aircraft. If you take aircraft, somebody came out on Facebook actually saying this needs to be done. I think it was, they said on the Stuka and something else, because there's no drawings or whatever, you know, we need to. And yeah. It's like, well, the applications here are fantastic. So it's modern technology that we can use on something historic, and look what we can do. And then, funny enough, and we've just been talking today, and hopefully if we get the agreement, we're going to go and see them, is the company which may be printing some parts of the Spitfire for this project is Fraser-Nash. Now, Fraser-Nash, if anybody knows anything about Second World War bombers, will know that Fraser-Nash made gun turrets for Lancasters and people during the Second World War. And here they are, all these years later, now making new parts for the aviation industry like this. So, yeah. So I love that. I love that. Although it's sort of historic aviation, I am a geek and I will sit there and watch black and white footage all day long. But I also like to think, well, we can package this up and make this vibrant and make this interesting and try and get that connection to what's going on today and what was happening back there.
Okay, I understand about the bulletins, but the key thing that really appeals to me are the features that you produce.
Yeah. The idea with that is I see a lot of information coming out of across social media these days, and as soon as an aeroplane's you know, restored, flown, or something happens to it, or a piece of information comes out of an archive, people are right across that. And what we want to do with the, what we're doing with the bulletin is we want to try and harness that and get that into a 10 minute or a program once a month to sort of to consolidate it and try and get all these bits and pieces dragged together. That's kind of where the bulletin's going now. In the past, a lot of magazines were doing this, and magazines were doing it. Well, they still do it. They still do it very, very well. But the trouble with a magazine is that by the time it's gone to print and everything, you can be 6 weeks out of date or whatever with the information. The great thing that we've got the way we can do it, we can put it together very quickly. We can get it out there. Literally, we can report on things that happened the week before or whatever. So that's the idea. It's in its early days, the bulletin. And what we're going to try and do is, looking forward, we want to get people feeding into us, really. That's the thing we haven't quite achieved yet, is we know that there's lots of people out there who are sort of on their own accord researching projects, doing things, and we'd like to get them coming into the bulletin and sort of feeding into us and being able to give them a voice for what they're doing. I'm really keen on that. And interestingly, and I know you're sort of you're an advocate of doing this, of trying to support other projects that are going along, I'm really passionate about people like sort of small groups and small sort of independent museums. People are out there trying to do something. And if we can give any support, and we can sort of channel publicity and bits and pieces to these smaller groups, that's something I would personally like to do. Because you've got the big national museums have got obviously government money behind them. They can go out there and they've got these machines. But you find on almost every ex-RAF airfield is a small museum run by really enthusiastic volunteers. And these guys are the guys that I find really interesting, because that's where the passion runs really deep. And I've seen it recently with the Hawkinge Museum down in Kent, where they've just taken on this Bristol Blenheim project. And the way the guys got together to try and put this together, to get it ready for opening up for the season, was just brilliant. I think, wow, this is great. And there's this small group of volunteers, people putting in their time, and it's such a historic, aviation-wise, it's a really historic, important Battle of Britain airfield. These guys need a voice, and let's help them.
And some of your features are quite impressive. Not only are they really original in terms of the content on historical projects, but you've put it together in a innovative and well-structured way. It takes you on a journey. That's quite some undertaking. The first one I looked at was the short Sunderland, and the detail you had to go to was very intensive to produce.
They are, and I learned very, very quickly that you cannot afford to put something out there with a mistake in it, because within seconds, people are out pointing out the mistake you've made.
Everyone's got a voice,
And rightly so. I think as a content producer, you do your utmost to try and get things right. I have definitely made mistakes myself. I made mistakes live on air and things when you get your words mixed up or whatever, but you do strive to try and get everything right. The flying boat was a fascinating story, because these guys had come across the propeller, which was dragged up out of the water. Yeah. Nobody knew that the aircraft was there. Just to give a sort of a background on it, it was a Sunderland which we believe sank at its moorings in 1944. Every piece of evidence looks to that. But again, what the sort of the adventure for us was the fact that we went out with the divers who were looking at it to go down and have a look and see if they could find it. We went through the archives, through the newspaper cuttings, to see what reports we could find. And it was just piecing this story of something, an aeroplane which was which had sunk, was under the water, had been there for years, and had suddenly been found. And it opened up lots of sort of little corridors into other stories. So while we were looking for that particular aircraft, one of the guys who was researching the project I came across another Sunderland which had sunk very close to where this one was, and it had caught fire, and a guy who was passing, one of the RAF guys in a boat. It sounds a bit weird to have an RAF guy in a boat.
Yeah.
But they were obviously the flying boats, and they needed tenders up to them. He actually rescued two guys off this aircraft, which literally took hold, you know, the flames took hold of this aircraft within seconds, and he won the George Medal for that. And it was largely forgotten story, and to find that little story in amongst, you know, although it wasn't the aircraft we were looking at, it's like, well, great, there's another piece of interesting history which we can bolt onto this. There is, you know, there was this sort of mystery element to the fact that the aircraft went down. What we still don't know was the Sunderland wreck is on the bottom of the Solent. But what we don't know is why the front end of the aircraft has been removed. And according to the divers, it's been removed clean. It looks like it's been cut off. And I've heard all kinds of conspiracy theories, you know, sort of somebody saying there was some top secret, you know, sort of equipment in the front all the way through to something to do with the Cold War, you know, sort of going on to... I think probably, you know, the most logical explanation, it was probably cut off as an underwater exercise or something, you know, with an underwater...
Yeah.
But it's still... The fact is, it's like, why did this happen? And that's the thing. Why was this aircraft, you know, so why did it, so what, why was it there? It kind of, those, you start exploring it and you start to see all this other history. And Calshot is where this aircraft is a fascinating, yep, place. If you go down there, if you know what you're looking for, you'll spot, oh, you think, well, that's an aircraft hangar, okay, but there's no runway here, and there's a few sort of information boards, but the majority of people who go down there do not realize the aviation history that was there. There were thousands of men down there during the Second World War running the flying boats. And before the war, the Schneider Trophy contests were run from there. Several world speed records were broken over that area. And again, it's just unearthing that piece of history. And so from the point of view of the film, we can go down there and say, well, look, you know, you stood on a beach here and there's a building. Well, what does it mean? Well, it means a lot more than you think. And you go into this, and that's where I get really excited, because we're discovering it. And like you say, it's the journey, what we can find out about this. Yeah.
The time, energy and money that's gone into some of your programs is quite astonishing.
Well, time is the thing. We've had a lot of guys who've come in and given their time for free. All the the divers who came looked at that. They did it out of pure interest, out of for them, which has been great. And it's the time that it takes to look at these stories and put it all together. And that's a frustrating thing, because I would love to start on a story on Monday and finish it on a Friday and then get it out the next week. Unfortunately, it takes several weeks to get these right.
The production and the quality of the content is very, very high. Is this something you considered before you started producing Plane Hunters? Is that something you thought about? The videos, how do you handle some of the older videos where the quality looks really good?
Well, that's down to my day job, because that's what we do. As I say, I run a production company, so we're striving. This day and age, we don't want to put stuff out there which is substandard. And my frustration is that if we have more money to spend on it and more time, we'd make it look even better. But that's the thing. We want it to look good, because we want it to appeal to a lot of people, and that's where and everything we do visually, we think about in the sense of how can we show this off. What are we going to do? I mean, a prime example is we're looking a new story which is coming up, and I'll keep you posted on how we go with this. But in the Solent Sky Museum is a Merlin engine, and now this Merlin engine was dragged up somewhere around the region at some point, and was given to the museum in about 1985, 1986. Now, it was pulled up by a fisherman, and he never gave any information as to where it had come from. And there was either two reasons for that. One, he didn't want anybody fishing in that spot, or he was fishing somewhere he shouldn't have done. But he dragged it up with his nets, and it got caught and tangled in everything. And he just pulled it up and he dumped it in the museum, and sort of, well, there's a Merlin engine. Now, at the time, no, the museum gladly accepted it and put it on display, but nobody did any research work on it. And it's lay there for over 30 years now. And it just happened, we started looking at it and thinking, well, hold on, there's a story behind this. So we've started to look at that. Almost instantly, going to the engine number, which is on there from Rolls-Royce, takes us up so far to the batch number and everything. What we haven't been able to do as of yet is get into finding out what the RAF, the information from the RAF to say which aircraft this was on or where it came from. Now, so this is a great sort of like, you know, sort of for me, it's like this is a great starting point. Have we got an aircraft here which nobody, you know, where did it come from? Is it something that, you know, it's a wreck that people know of and the fishermen happened to find it? Or is there an aircraft out there somewhere which was lost in the Ogden? All indication at the moment, it looks as though it might be a bomber engine. And so, you know, is there a story of a bomber which has gone down somewhere with seven men in it or whatever, you know, sort of. So we're starting to sort of trace this back. Now, visually, to show that off, we've got a rusty old engine or heavily corroded engine. And so that's where our discussions are at the moment. How are we going to show this, you know, how are we going to make this appealing to lots of people to say, you know, this isn't just a hunk of metal. This is a story. And how do we how do we take that back? How do we make that? So that's where our sort of process starts with. And at the moment, I'll tell you that I can't give too much about it away at the moment because we're filming it next week. But I've just had to purchase a pair of waders to go out into some mud flats somewhere, which is going to be exciting. So just
to make note. There seems to be a lot of water involved in your program so far.
Well, there is. At the moment, it just seems to have gone that way. Yes. Yeah.
As I said, it's primarily a visual medium, but where can we find you online?
Right. Well, if you're on social media, our Facebook page is the place to follow and like, which is go over, it's at Plane Hunters and you'll find us there. We try to update once a week. So we don't bombard you with stuff, but just keep you in the loop of what's going on. In the build up to what we like to do, and we did last year, is as we were making the films, we were posting bits and pieces that were going on. And then when the films come out, we'll let people know. The same with the bulletins on that. If you're not on social media, and there are a lot of people who aren't, I can understand that completely. If you pop along to planehunters.com, you'll find us on there. And we try to update the website regularly, sort of following with what we're doing. You'll be able to pick up and see all the feeds in there. And that's the two main ports of call for us.
Right. Okay. What about YouTube?
Yes, YouTube as well. So if you go to planehunters.com, you will find our YouTube films. But get onto YouTube and search for Plane Hunters. And certainly if you're looking for the flying boat one, search for the lost flying boat. That's one of our successes at the moment. We've had, I think we're near enough had 60,000 views on that in the last couple of months, which has been great. Wow. And interesting looking at that, it's because, of course, we can see roughly where people are looking from. We've got a lot of people from the United States watching that one, which is interesting. It sort of shows how far the net goes, as it were. And do subscribe to the YouTube channel. We can keep you updated with what's going on.
Andy, thanks so much for joining us. Love the program. We'll stay in touch and keep a track on what you're doing.
No, that's no problem.
And good luck with all the projects.
Oh, thank you so much.
Listen. I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
We know you're in there.
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And next up is Kevin James. Kevin is an author and wrote the book Heathrow Airport, An Illustrated History, that I actually reviewed at the back end of last year. I'll put some links to that in the show notes. We talked to him about that book. We talked to him about his other books, Airport Days and Nights, Terminals and Runways, as well as some non-aviation stuff. Kevin has a very strong opinion on lots of things. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. But I do have to apologise in advance. We recorded in a cafe and sadly I struggled a little bit to keep the noise of the background under control. So I do apologise again. I hope this doesn't ruin your enjoyment of this interview. Kevin has an awful lot to say. I'm sure you'll enjoy his views. You may not agree with them all, but you should enjoy the discussion we've had. Here's Kevin James. I'm with Kevin James, freelance journalist and author, and we're in a cafe in Rochester, so do excuse us the background noises. But Kevin, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much. It's, yes, a little noisy in here, but then again, we could be in a disco full of raving teenagers, but we're not.
It sounds like it. It sounds like it. Kevin, we're going to talk about some of your books and your interest in aviation, but tell me a little bit about where the aviation bug came for you. Where did it all start?
I haven't a clue. It's just always been there. My earliest memories is having my face stuck to an airliner window and being fascinated by it all, and my dad peering over my shoulders as we took off and pointing out how small everything was getting as we climbed higher after takeoff, and he made the point that they looked like my toy cars at home, and I've just been fascinated by it ever since. But strangely, it's not just the aircraft themselves, but it's also airports that have a fascination for me, and again, I have no idea where. It's just always been there.
Right, okay. Now, you talk about being on aeroplanes. Tell me about your father and how some of that came about, that you flew so much in your younger years.
Well, Dad worked for the British Forces Broadcasting Service, so every time we were posted, we flew.
Yeah.
He also had numerous occasions where he needed to go to one station somewhere or the other, and he often was able to take me with him. So we flew some more. So it's something I got used to. Again, it's many people fly not because they want to necessarily, but because they have to.
Yeah.
Me personally, I'd do it simply for the hell of it. I just like doing it.
Yeah.
And I like being in airports as well.
Yeah.
I might be weird, but there you are.
No, it's an affliction I suffer from too. And I was delighted to read your book last year, and we're going to talk a bit about that. I just want to tease out, though, a little bit more about some of those flights in the early days. You've mentioned VC-10s to me before we hit the record button. What other aircraft did you fly back in the day?
Well, my earliest recollection is one that I don't actually have any recollection about at all, but according to my mother, you had to get in at the back, and the front end was higher than the back end, which meant climbing up to get to our seats.
Yeah.
But it had four engines, so it wasn't a Dakota.
Okay.
My guess is it was probably an RAF Hastings.
Okay.
After that, the Britannia, the Vanguard, the Viscount. I don't think I've been...
VC-10 as well.
Well, that came along when it came along. But,
yeah.
But prior to that, it was those early turboprops, or later versions of them.
What do you remember from the experience of flying in those? Because so much has changed in the decades since. And, you know, we now get into a Ryanair or an EasyJet aircraft. It's very similar. What do you remember from those days flying those wonderful propeller-driven aircraft?
Big windows.
Yeah.
Because both the Viscount and the Vanguard had enormous big round windows. And when you're little, they're almost as big as you are.
Yeah.
so seeing out of them wasn't a problem. Also, the whistling noise that the Viscount's engines made.
Those dark turbo.
Yep, and to a lesser degree, the Vanguard as well. But next after that were the short-haul jets like the Caravelle and the BSU-111 and, of course, the Trident. Which we use quite a lot.
This is just nostalgic for me, just talking these aircraft that they're all gone from our airfields now, but you've managed to capture in your book. Tell me about the journey and the, I suppose, the thinking behind writing a book about Heathrow's history. Where did that all start? What was the inspiration?
The inspiration goes back 20 years to a book written by an American journalist called James Kaplan, who wrote a book called The Airport, Terminal Days and Runway Nights at JFK. And I got a copy of that for my birthday from my dad, and I was entranced by this. This is how you write an airport book. And Kaplan didn't simply present facts. He wrote it from the first-person point of view, from his point of view, about what it was like to go there, interview people, talk to them, and find things out about the airport. Kaplan was like me. He'd travelled fairly widely. I think probably the biggest difference between us is that I probably know a bit more about aviation than he did. But nonetheless, we are still both passengers because I don't work in the airline industry and never have. I write about it, but other than that, I've never been an aviation professional.
Tell me about some of that writing outside of the books. You've written for some of the big airline airport publications, haven't you?
Yeah, I contribute regularly to Airports of the World magazine. There's also an article in the works for Aviation News on Singapore Airlines. I've also had articles published by Airliner World. It's what I call the last third of my working life now. You can divide life into threes. First, you get born, you grow up, go to school, get educated, and then whether it's further education or whether you leave school at 16 or 18, you then go and do something for a living. And then you get to the last third, which is for most people is retirement. But since I'm not of retirement age yet, I have no intention of retiring anyway, but I got to the point where I thought, well, okay, I've done all the stuff that I had to do. Now I want to do something that I want to do, which is write and take photographs. Because I've got enough life behind me, I've got enough experience of the subject now to do it reasonably well. And having spent a lot of my time previously designing and producing literature of varying kinds, as well as writing news articles and similar, it gave me the experience and background to do it.
And you've got a unique style to your writing. You don't only write about aviation and airlines and airports. You write other books. You're full of opinions on subjects, and that really comes through in the book on the history of Heathrow Airport. But the way you've written the book is unique. I could associate it with it because I almost felt I was there with you. I saw some of that. It reminded me of many of the things I saw. But why did you write the book in the style that you wrote it? You know, it was very engaging, first person. It wasn't a historical tome.
To be a little different, Heathrow was celebrating its 70th anniversary, and there have been numerous books written about the airport, some of them good, most of them are, some of them not quite so good. But I simply wanted to present something a little different, merely because, well, actually no, entirely because, I freely admit to not being normal. being normal is not for me.
Right.
So I wrote it from the same point of view that Kaplan did with his book on New York, which was to, instead of blandly present facts, instead of just blandly presenting facts, to present a story,
right.
Which obviously involved talking to people that worked there as well, so that's what I did.
And there are some wonderful stories in the book, and we've just talked about a photograph of a lad sitting on the fence looking at some Tridents. Those days are long gone. Heathrow's very changed from those times. What you've been able to do is provide a reflection on the sort of 70s, 80s. You've captured images that probably would have been lost How do you think Heathrow's changed over that time? What's your personal impression of Heathrow and what it is becoming?
Well, it's got bigger terminals for a start. And only two runways, whereas, as you read in the book, it started out with six.
Yeah.
Now it wants a third. Personally, I think it needs not just a third runway, it needs a third and a fourth. Because two are not enough. Three will go some way towards solving the problem, but it needs two more. But to do that, of course, means taking up extra land, which is where the controversy comes from. But as to how it's changed, well, the Star of David shape that it had when it was originally built is long gone now. And you have a linear arrangement with the two runways, north and south, and the terminals in rows in between them, which is becoming a fairly standard look to many airports around the world because it's the most practical way of doing it. The difference between Heathrow and somewhere like Denver, for example, which was built to that similar style to start with, is that Heathrow have had to do it on an existing site, a very small site. So for them to have done as much as they have, I think is an amazing feat and a testimony to the airport management and the people that work there, not to mention the airlines as well.
Yeah. And I sort of look back nostalgically at the Queen's building and Terminal 2 now that's almost gone. And the days when I started going, Terminal 3 was very new. It was the modern terminal, but now, of course, is probably the oldest and it needs some serious change as well. What are some of the more positive changes you've seen over that time?
Well, as much as one might not like to say it, there's no doubt that the original terminal, what became Terminal 2, had outlived its usefulness. It was too small. Likewise, Terminal 1, that had become too small, yet Terminal 1, when it opened, was the largest single airport terminal in Europe. And yet it still proved to be too small. It shows you how traffic has gone up at Heathrow.
Are we in pain of making that same mistake again with Heathrow? It's going to get a third runway. You've mentioned it needs two. Are we just going to be constrained in another decade or so looking at the same problem?
Undoubtedly we will. The thing about building two new runways at Heathrow is that it needs to be done in tandem with a second at Gatwick and a second at Stansted. Now, that point of view will undoubtedly cause huge controversy. But if you started building those runways now, once they are done, and it would take 3 to 5 years to construct another one at Stansted, another one at Gatwick, and two more at Heathrow, you can't build any more because the skies will be full.
Yeah.
When the Heathrow recommendation for a third runway was made by the commission that sat and discussed it, and then the decision was subsequently ratified, Boris Johnson was quoted on national newspapers saying that various other cities were of this or that historical antecedents and that London would be the city of planes. Well, of course, he's exaggerating wildly because it won't be. But the sky is not as empty as it seems. So, you know, there are aerial corridors for aircraft to use, and once they have reached their capacity, it doesn't matter how many runways you've got, you simply cannot fit any more aircraft into the sky, and we're at that point now. So building two new runways at Heathrow, one more at Gatwick and one more at Stansted, would serve London's needs for as long as aircraft need runway to take off on, land on. If we ever get to the stage where they can do it vertically, you can do away with the runways because you won't need them anymore, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. So you need the runways. But airports are only of use if aircraft can fly efficiently and safely in between them. And we have reached the point now where the skies are not quite full, but we're not far away off of that, which is part of the reason behind the design and production of aircraft like the Airbus A380. And it's significant that Heathrow now has more A380 flights to it than any other airport in the world. And the reason for that, of course, is because it is so constrained by its size.
Yeah. And where do you see that going in the next decade or so? Airlines are changing, airports are changing, our buying habits are changing, we're all changing. Is Heathrow going to get left behind, you know, with Dubai opening a second airport, with the challenges from Schiphol, to a lesser extent, some of the French airports in Paris, Germany, of course, you know, that hub that was always the centre of most aviation, international aviation networks was Heathrow. Can it keep it?
Oh, yeah. You see, Heathrow doesn't compete with Amsterdam or Paris or Frankfurt. People go to London because they want to go to London. They don't want to go to Frankfurt and then have to make a long, further journey, a point I made in my book. So that isn't going to change. You said our buying habits change. Yes, they do. What will drive Heathrow's further growth, and the same applies to anywhere else and anything else to that matter, is the demands made upon it by its customers, which is us, the passengers. Boeing have not followed Airbus's lead with a very large passenger capacity aircraft like the Airbus A380 because they do not believe that the market is there to sustain it. And events have, I think, proved Boeing right in that Airbus have sold enough A380s to keep the production line open, but there is a lot of orders following up. And Boeing's 747, the original jumbo jet, is now reaching the end of its days. Because airlines are going for slightly smaller aircraft, and they're doing that because people don't want to fly via big hub airports and change flights anymore. There is still room for that, which is why airlines like Emirates have made a success of Dubai. Airlines like Singapore Airlines make a success of it in Singapore. Heathrow's in a slightly different situation in that it has to compete only with other airlines that fly to it. So British Airways, if they want to remain one of the world's leading airlines, still need a hub airport like Heathrow. But Heathrow doesn't just serve British Airways and its needs, it serves London and the country as a whole. There isn't the demand for another airport in the UK like Heathrow. There simply isn't. The closest we have to it is Manchester, because it's far enough from Heathrow to make flying there direct from somewhere else in the world viable, but it's still nowhere near as busy as Heathrow because Heathrow serves London and Manchester is not London.
Kevin, second book I want to talk to you about is Airport Days and Nights, Terminals and Runways. I've not read this one yet. I enjoyed the last book on Heathrow and its history. Tell me about Days and Nights.
It's a compilation of airports that I've travelled through, that my two co-authors, Faye Johnson and Tyler McDowell, have travelled through. Airports that we took pictures at. Unlike the book on Heathrow, it does cover a multitude of airports and our journeys through them. And there will be a companion edition to go with it, which tells the story of how myself, Faye and Tyler grew up. And it might answer, to perhaps to a better degree, your earlier question of where my interest came from. On the other hand, it might not. It just enlarges on the same point, which I have no idea where it came from. But that essentially is it. I mean, you've got a copy there, so if you want to have a quick look through it, then by all means, ask me any questions you want about it. But all I would say to people is go buy it. It's wonderful.
And not just because we're here together, Kevin. I do like your material. I like your style. I don't always agree with everything else on social media, but isn't that the world we live in? How do you think aviation journalism has changed in the years? You know, looking back over your experience, you write for magazines, you've written books. What do you think people are looking for in what they want to read about in this day and age?
Sex, drugs and rock and roll.
And you've got some stories on that, I know, but this is an aviation programme.
Well, I mean, I have to admit, actually, I'm not a member of the Mile High Club and I've got no particular desire to join it. But I think, essentially, people really want to get where they want to go as fast as they possibly can and as cheaply as they possibly can. But I don't see that people's desires have changed any very much over the years. When it comes to reading about it, The magazines that I write for are doing well, so there's obviously a market for them. Otherwise, people wouldn't buy them, and I wouldn't get a job writing for them. And the same applies to books. I think if you want to read a book that simply presents bare facts, there are plenty of those that will cater for that. But I think they will probably sell a little less than a book that sings at you, a book that flows. It's an individual thing, obviously. So different people have different requirements and have different needs and desires.
So tell us what's in the pipeline for Kevin. You're always up to something. There's always something on social media that you're talking about, have an opinion of, or want more interest in. What's in the aviation and airline pipeline?
Oh, I do wish you'd left the question as it was to start with, because I'd have started talking about some of my other stuff as well. But in aviation, there is a companion edition to Airport Days and Nights Terminal and Runways called Airport Days and Nights Evolution. There's also a third book to go along with it, so it will be a trilogy. And the third one is Airport Days and Nights Today and Tomorrow, and the title of that should be fairly self-explanatory. There will be, at some point, a second edition of the Heathrow book, but that point we are not at yet, because the story is not over. It's not going to be over anyway at any point, because it is literally a never-ending story. But at the same time, there comes a point where you can at least pause and look at where you are, and that's what will happen with the Heathrow subject. The obvious starting point for that is going to be when the parliamentary vote is held. And whether that is, yes, fine, go ahead and build it, or no, you're not going to build it. Whichever the decision is, there's going to be a story of itself right there. Most of that, I think, will come later, because there will be protests galore, there will be movements in support of it as well. So I think once we've had that vote and looked at what the immediate fallout is, that'll be as good a time as any to look at updating the Heathrow story.
One final question then about airlines and airports. Are they commodities now? All those aircraft we talked about, you know, Vanguards and VC-10s and Tridents and 727s and jumbo jets, are we just seeing a mediocrity of aircraft flying our skies into any airport in the world that looks the same?
I don't think you can talk on them as being just commodities, but the reason they look as they do now is because it's the most efficient way of designing a commercial passenger carrying aircraft, which does have the rather sad side effect of them looking rather similar. And the same applies to airport terminals. So you can say, when you've been in one airport, you've been in them all. When you've flown in one airline, you've flown in them all. But they are all different. So no, I don't think they're commodities. We haven't reached the limit of design yet. They will change again further, and they will also get quieter. Even though there are those who would say the opposite, but they will. I mentioned earlier the prospect of airliners being able to land and take off vertically. Well, the technology isn't exactly new. It's a question of, can you economically apply that technology to something that's big enough to make it commercially viable? So airliner development hasn't finished. Airport development hasn't finished. There's still a long way to go.
Put you on the spot then. Favourite airport, favourite aircraft?
Favourite airport, favourite aircraft. Favourite aircraft is probably the Boeing 777.
Okay, I didn't expect that.
Well, yeah.
I expected something a little older.
No.
Why the 777?
It's wonderful. I think it's the epitome of modern day aircraft. When you consider that it first went into service 19 years ago. It's actually not in the first flush of youth anymore. So if you're an early customer for the 777, what you replace it with is another 777. Airbus make good aircraft, but I don't think they've got anything that is quite as good as the 777. I haven't flown on a 787 yet, or on an Airbus A350, so I can't compare them, so I don't know. But it just strikes a chord within me.
Okay. And is Heathrow your favourite airport?
I don't have a favourite airport. I love them all. But there is there is one that I haven't been to that I want to go to, and that's Paro or Paro in Bhutan.
Wow.
Because it's located at the bottom of a valley and surrounded by towering mountains, and it's been described to me by those who have been there that getting to it is absolutely bloody terrifying. So bring it on, I want to go. Heathrow, by comparison, is boring.
So, Kevin, just before we go, give us a little teaser of some of the other material you've written about. Not necessarily aviation-related, but you're quite prolific.
Well, there are people who have written more books than I have, that's for sure. But as an example, we have Comments of a Common Man, which is shortly about to have a second edition. It's a reflection of life itself. I'm not particularly special, but the number of conversations I have with people on Facebook and other social media, as well as in the pub and club, or just walking down the street. Comments of a Common Man simply reflects the opinions of ordinary people. And it's rather unkind in places to politicians, Jobsworths, high-vis wearing people, and those who tell us what to do. Essentially, the point about the book is that there is a huge threat to our freedom in this country. Unless we wake up, we're going to lose it. I've also written a novel called Boy Sold, which is pretty horrific stuff. That's the first of a trilogy, which concerns underage prostitution, drug taking and stuff like that. So it's not for the faint-hearted.
Yeah. And you're also interested in photography. Obviously, we talked a little bit about pictures from the airport, but you're a keen photographer.
Yep, I've been taking pictures since I was at school. So there's another book that came out quite recently called Boyhood, Soccer, Skaters, Streets and such like, which is a compilation of pictures that I've taken since I was at school, including pictures that I took at school. And it just shows how kids have changed or not changed over the years. And it includes my friends at school. More modern times, we have skateboarders. There are a couple of pictures of skateboarders in Cologne when I was still a teenager myself. These days, I think my Achilles tendons won't let me stay on a skateboard anymore. But, some of them, some of the sequences of pictures in there were taken of people who were quite willing to set aside a bit of time to do it. Others are more spontaneous, off-the-cuff moments. I did that partly because there is something of a myth concerning photographing children and young people, in that people think that it's against the law. Well, it's not. There is no law against photographing children. There never has been in the UK. Hopefully there never will be. So in one sense, by publishing that, I'm sticking a finger up at those who want to quell the vitality and freedom we have. And what I've done is I've actually presented a record of our social history, and that's the point of it. Because if we stop taking pictures, we will stop recording our history, and we'll lose it. We'll lose it for good. And I think that would be a great shame.
So where can we find out about you online? Where can we find out about the books?
Facebook. All my books have their own Facebook pages. Well, it'll be one page, I think, at some point. It's just a question of going and looking for Kevin James Books, or the book title.
How about following you on social media?
That depends if I know you. I tweet from time to time.
Yeah.
If enough people go and buy my books, then there'll probably be a requirement for me to have a more public face. But for that to happen, people are going to have to go my books. So don't be tight-fisted. Get your credit cards out, get your wallets out, and go buy them.
Very good. Kevin, thank you very much for your time today.
You're entirely welcome.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace,
Find out about the professional and personal benefits that society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Okay, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can, of course, find Extended on all the major podcast playing platforms, including Stitcher.com and, of course, Apple Podcasts, I believe it's called now. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. We'll be back very soon, and with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency, that is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.